This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. When Faz Shakir joined the ACLU this past January, the organization was still preparing for the inauguration of Donald Trump. Months prior to Shakir's arrival, the ACLU released a letter addressed to Trump threatening to sue him if he acted on several of his campaign promises.
He did, and they did. Since his first week in office, the ACLU has been fighting the Trump administration in court. But in conjunction with these legal battles, the ACLU has been working to build up its political arm in Washington and around the country.
And that's where Shakir comes in. He's the national political director for the ACLU. He was in Milwaukee recently to deliver a speech at the ACLU of Wisconsin's Bill of Rights celebration. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about his work and the ACLU's position as a political institution.
The ACLU is a 97-year-old legal institution that has been known for filing wonderful cases throughout its history for gender equality and racial equality, marriage equality. But increasingly, since the election of Trump, we feel a need to build up our political muscle because we can't always count on the courts to deliver the most important victories. And quite frankly, at this time, as you look around the country, some of our strength is not in Congress, it's not in the presidency, it's not in state legislatures, it's not in governorships. And you think about how the ACLU, with its mission of trying to change hearts and minds around civil rights and civil liberties in America, can do its job. The political director's job has meant mobilizing our power, and our power is generally with people. It's with activists all across the country who are eager and fired up for a new direction for our country. They see an assault on civil rights and civil liberties like never before in their lifetimes, and they want to do something about it. And so coming in as a new political director in January of this year, I felt like it was really critical that the ACLU needs to build a grassroots mobilization program. It needs to be more communicative with lay people on the street to give activists an opportunity to engage in these fights, to do something, to affiliate with the ACLU to accomplish our mission.
Is the ACLU political?
Yes, the ACLU is a political organization, for sure. It is not a partisan organization. I would make a distinction between those two. Partisan, of course, it means that you're advocating for the election or defeat of a particular candidate by virtue of their identification with the Democratic Party, Republican Party, or any other party. But we're a political organization that advocates for policy change. That's what I call a political advocacy organization. Someone who is looking to change surveillance laws in our country, the laws that govern reproductive health, the laws that govern LGBT equality. Those are things that we care deeply about. We fight for them in the courts, but we also fight for them in state legislatures. And because we do that, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us to utilize every tool at our disposal. So as I was saying, it's not just litigating in courts. It's not just calling up a few state lawmakers and saying, hey, can you do this wonderful thing? It's got to be broader than that, particularly at this day and age when the threats are so grave and we seem to be constantly playing on defense on many of these issues. So we've got to mobilize the public, and that has been at the forefront of every thought of building up a new political program at the ACLU.
When we say mobilize the public, I feel like we hear these kinds of terms a lot, but they end up being these sort of amorphous terms for what?
Yeah.
What does mobilizing the public actually look like?
It's a great question, and I think of it as in two buckets. There's one that's just the women's march style mobilization, like get out, get your voices heard, or what we did during the Affordable Care Act, call your member of Congress, just pick up the phone and do something. When we were building our political program, we wanted to join in all of those things, but we really had a different model of what we thought mobilization should be. Our program is called People Power. You can access it at peoplepower.org. We built it on a creed and a belief. We wanted to give people a meaningful action that they could take in their community to accomplish policy change. Let me give you a specific example of what we said. So we're like, okay, I want to empower volunteer activists to be pseudo-staff of the ACLU to accomplish things that we as ACLU staff alone could not do. And so one of the first things we said is let's mobilize to protect immigrants all across the nation from Trump's mass deportation agenda. And let's try to build freedom cities, what we call freedom cities, and change some of the laws in our cities that pertain to how cops can ask you about your status and how long they can keep you in jail and what they can pull you into jail for. And we mobilized all across the country asking volunteer activists to advocate for a set of model rules and ordinances pertaining to immigration laws, sanctuary city type laws. And we said, you know, we can't do this ourselves, so we're turning the ball over to you. We would appreciate if you could go meet with your local sheriff, your local law enforcement, your mayor, your city council, and see if they'd be willing to adopt these welcoming ordinances. And oh my God, it's amazing. When you ask people to step up and you treat them with respect and you give them a high bar, an ambitious goal, they take to it. So all across the country, we've seen Ann Arbor, Michigan take this up and pass it. Dane County here, Madison, passed it. Phoenix, Arizona, Middlesex County, New Jersey, Berwyn, Illinois, Rockville, Maryland, Silver City, New Mexico, all across the country. They shock you and surprise you because they took it upon themselves to advocate for the policy change that they wanted to see with just a little guidance from the ACLU.
One of the things you just mentioned is kind of the fight against a lot of the proposals from the Trump administration. So even before Trump gets into office, the ACLU had already built out a plan of how to combat some of the things he was proposing. They accused him of essentially going against the Constitution. After his election, the head of the ACLU sends him a letter, you know, citing which amendments he would be going against. What's happened since then? You know, there were all these plans to do all of these different things. What's happened?
Oh, man. It's been a whirlwind. It's been a whirlwind. So flashing back to the middle of last year, we're in the middle of like the DNC convention, the Republican convention, and most people— check me on this, but most people were like, oh, you know, Hillary's on the path to winning. And so here, Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, is urging the entire institution to do a documentation of Trump's policy positions and identify where his policies might be in contravention of the Constitution. And he's asking his staff to do that. And most of the people are like, why? Like, don't you know Hillary's going to win? And so we produce the Trump memos. And it provided the guide map for the possibility that Trump might win. And guess what? He did. And it positioned the ACLU, I think, to have an approach right out of the box. And as you suggested and mentioned, on the day after he was elected, we wrote a letter in the New York Times, took out a full-page ad, and said, we'll see you in court. If you pursue all of the unconstitutional threats and pledges that you've made during the course of the campaign, we documented them all across the board. If you pursue these, then we're going to challenge you in court. And we have done that. So 1 week in to the administration, right? He's inaugurated on January 20th. 1 week in, January 27th, he issues the Muslim ban. And within hours, we're in a Brooklyn courtroom and successfully win a lawsuit there. Almost every court across America after that ruled against him, not only on the Muslim ban 1.0, but then 2.0. We're still stuck in a legal morass over that as he tries to pursue a discriminatory law. So it wasn't just the Muslim ban. We've been so busy on so many immigration matters. I mean, just recently, I've seen the Trump administration, tried to detain a woman and prevent her from having an abortion. And that was her constitutional right. We argued it, and we won that case. The case was called Jane Doe because we didn't want her identity made public. But that was another, you know, an intersectional issue, an immigration issue and a reproductive health issue joined together. We just saw another one, Rosa, a young girl at the border who was detained and because she was having gallbladder surgery and was separated from her family. We advocated and fought for her release and got that. So we've won that one too. Trump issued a ban on transgender persons from serving in the military. We're fighting that one in court and we're winning in court. We're busy. There's a lot of work to do. But I guess I take heart from the past 10, 11 months that the resistance is working. The rule of law is working. The courts are serving as a good check on the excesses of President Trump. So I generally feel positive and good about the direction that we're going. And now we see the American public starting to vote for a change in direction as well.
Now, you're actually the son of immigrants from Pakistan. Yeah. How personal are these battles for you?
You know, I was raised Muslim. I have a funny name. I'm a brown-skinned person. And there are days when I wake up and I hear the things that Trump says. I'm like, man, this guy thinks I am the enemy. He thinks, like, essentially, I need to be kicked out of this country, or I need to be surveilled. I need to that I am a threat. And it doesn't feel good. But the fact that there are so many people who affiliate and sound support for this perspective is heartwarming. I mean, you remember, I was just referring to the Muslim ban. The story of the Muslim ban was that thousands upon thousands of non-Muslims rushed into airports to defend their Muslim brothers and sisters, their neighbors. And seeing the reaction from such a broad swath of the American public said, hell no, like, this is not what we stand for. That makes it all much, much better.
Now, I'm not sure how familiar you might be with this particular situation, but I was listening to a program the other day about the decades-long surveillance of Muslim communities in the United States. So that has been, they FOIA requested quite a lot of documents, thousands upon thousands of documents about these mostly just everyday people, families, kids, who the FBI, I should say, is keeping documents on. How much is the ACLU involved in that case?
Very much. We've had an issue where we've been fighting with the New York City Police Department over a lot of the practices that you said, surveillance of Muslim communities, going into mosques and tracking individuals, guilt by association. This is really essentially the problem that we face in the Muslim community, is that for so long, it was the Kevin Bacon game, you know, 7 degrees association with a terrorist. And they'd start with, oh, there's some guy from Hamas and there's some guy from Hezbollah. And like, he had a brother and then he married some sister and then he had 3 kids and then he had a friend and then he had an uncle and that uncle met with you and therefore you're a terrorist. That game has been played against every major Muslim who has risen to high office or become a public figure. I mean, you think of Keith Ellison, a congressman from Minnesota, just been dogged by, oh, he's a terrorist and we can't trust him. He affiliates with terrorist groups. There were individuals who served in the Bush White House, Suhail Khan, and a couple of other people who were attacked by conservatives. They were Republicans working for President Bush, and they were attacked by conservatives like Frank Gaffney, who said that they were inviting terrorists into the White House and they shouldn't be trusted. Certainly, you know, when I joined Nancy Pelosi's staff and Harry Reid's staff, there were articles online saying that, you know, I was a terrorist fundraiser because I had been in the Harvard Islamic Society. And that was it. Literally, I was in the Harvard Islamic Society and therefore I'm a terrorist. So it is the game that has been played all too often to detrimental effect and has really depressed many in the Muslim community from participating in American civic life. They're worried that any time they try to run for office or get involved in something high profile that they're going to be attacked in the same way. And so the ACLU has been heavily engaged in this. And we fight over things like the designation of terrorist groups or the government for a very long time. The designation of terrorist groups. We want to, of course, designate terrorist groups and we want it to be particularized and focused on actual terrorists. But what too often happens is the designation will then be broad enough that you can say, oh, well, anybody, you know, everybody who might have even said something in a certain way becomes a terrorist. They said Allahu Akbar, you know, and then therefore that becomes a grave threat. And as an organization committed to free speech, we want to make sure that we have an open society, a tolerant and accepting society, and punish wrongdoing and evildoing when it occurs through actual physical violence, through heinous harm inflicted upon others. But we don't want to punish people for merely having a point of view and a perspective.
Well, and on that point, the ACLU has taken a lot of heat for their representation of white supremacists. Most recently, there's a situation going on with Taylor Swift, whose lawyers sent a letter to a conservative blogger who essentially said that she was involved with white supremacy. Why does the ACLU continue to represent and defend white supremacists?
Because we believe in free speech for everybody. If you really believe in free speech for all, you're going to be tested in that belief by others who are going to pick the least popular group and push that group onto you and say, hey, you want free speech for that person? And if you allow for the encroachment upon speech restrictions for, let's say, white supremacists, you know who's coming next? It's going to be Black Lives Matter. It's going to be Greenpeace activists. It's going to be abortion protesters, abortion rights protesters. It's going to be pro-Palestinian protesters, right? All of these folks, marginalized or unpopular groups, people who have a thought that is considered on the fringe, they're going to be penalized and criminally punished for a point of view. That's something we are vigilantly on guard about. So we've defended in Charlottesville and in so many places the right of people with whom we disagree vehemently on racial justice matters, the right to speak. You know, as a political director, I'm not launching these lawsuits, but I am trying to mobilize the public around what we're trying to accomplish. And I think it's important that, you know, we're an organization that believes in more speech. Let's have more speech. And the best way that you can reject speech that you hate is by not showing up. I mean, imagine if an Ann Coulter or a Milo or Steve Bannon shows up to a college campus and has to speak to a room of 10 people. That's embarrassing. That's sad for them. And that's the way it should be. And I think oftentimes the effort to try to repress their speech only gets them more attention and gives them the satisfaction that they're looking for. So I think that from our perspective, we're trying to mobilize people in the instances where we end up representing somebody whose values we abhor. We're going to continue at the ACLU to mobilize the public in contravention to that person's ideas. So we'll represent a white supremacist in court, but we will simultaneously be mobilizing public to attend rallies or protests in defiance of the views of that person. We're going to live our values. We're going to live the fact that we believe in more speech, and we're going to promote more speech.
What is the ACLU's view on hate speech? Because I think that's where a lot of people get caught up. You mentioned Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. Greenpeace, and these organizations, yes, say things that a lot of people don't maybe agree with, but rarely do they engage in hate speech, in speech that encourages violence, unlike many of these white supremacist groups.
You use the key word there, violence. And that's where we draw a line. If you're coming to instigate violence, that's not speech. That's actually repressing speech. That's intimidating, right? That it's going to stop people from exercising their First Amendment right. And I think Charlottesville certainly caused our organization to become clearer about that. And I think the challenge with Charlottesville is when we represented the client there, he testified that he would not be engaging in a violent protest. Of course, we saw what ended up happening. And so should we and others who represent groups like that be more discerning or critical of the pledges that they make to us as our clients, right? So they say, hey, oh, no, we're not going to bring guns to this march. We're not going to engage in any violence. We need to probably engage in a much stronger effort to check that pledge that they're making to us and to critique it, to assess whether we think that's valid and whether they're going to hold to that. So that is one takeaway from Charlottesville, is that we probably got to be much more discerning about challenging the claims that people make to us. Secondly, when people are bringing arms to a protest, we've been clear that we're not going to represent you. When you bring guns, it too often is going to repress speech. It's going to intimidate others from not showing up, from being able to voice their opinion. And that's not a road that we want to go down.
Faz Shakir is the national political director for the ACLU. He was in Milwaukee to deliver a speech at the ACLU of Wisconsin's Bill of Rights celebration. There's more information at WUWM.com.